Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. Carrie Miles, who earned a PhD in organizational psychology at the University of Chicago and currently is a senior scholar in residence at Chapman University. She is also a non-resident scholar at Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion, the sponsor of our program, I should note. And she is also a scholar practitioner who puts her knowledge to good use as executive director of Empower International Ministries, an organization that we will hear a little bit more about during our conversation. Carrie specializes in issues revolving around economics, gender, and religion, and is author of The Redemption of Love, Rescuing Marriage and Sexuality from the Economics of a Fallen World. She also has published a number of Bible study guides that are in use in the United States, India, Haiti, and several nations in Africa where she is a frequent visitor. As always, there will be links to her books, related podcasts, and other cool stuff over at our website, so please visit us at www.researchonreligion.org. Carrie, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. My pleasure.
Our mission today is to venture off into some relatively uncharted scholarly waters that bring together a number of streams of academic research, and then also ask you a few questions about your work with the Christian nonprofit group Empower International Ministries. The uncharted waters that I speak of are the intersection of economics, religion, which includes both theology and the sociology of religion, and then the study of gender roles, as well as the topic of marriage. Now, you've noted in a recent book chapter that you published in the Oxford Handbook of Christianity and Economics, there's been a lot of research on economics of gender and the economics of marriage, and there's been a lot of focus on theology and gender issues. But if we drew a Venn diagram that intersects these three topics, economics, religion, and gender, well, that's pretty much a null set except for you. That seems to be your bailiwick. So tell us how you became interested in merging those three topics.
Well, I was raised a Mormon and went to BYU. And then when I did my doctoral dissertation, I looked at how, this was in the late 70s, I looked at how the Mormon Church was dealing with this pesky social change it didn't want to have to deal with, which was women's treatment in societies. Women, women should stay home and have children. The whole kind of traditional sexual division of labor. And so that got me very interested in the whole kind of general issue. I'm an organizational psychologist, so looking at it from that point of view. But one thing that becomes apparent when you start, when you have the economic kind of tool, the Gary Becker kind of approach to looking at that family and where the sexual division of labor has come from, is that a lot of religions have essentially reified and indeed spiritualized something that is in fact economically determined. So I'm interested in this economic study of marriage, family, the sexual division of labor, and from their gender, as because you want to drop that out in order to understand what religion is really saying, what, in my case, the foundational documents of Christianity, which would be the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, what they're really saying, and that's been my approach.
Now, you mentioned that you mentioned the name Gary Becker, and he's associated with the University of Chicago, which is where you did your PhD. When you went to graduate school at University of Chicago, were you thinking about doing this topic at all? Were you thinking about Gary Becker's work on the economics of marriage, or did this all just kind of come through the process of being there at Chicago at the time?
Actually, I finished my dissertation in 81, which is when I think the first version of Becker's Treatise on the Family came out. But my husband, Larry Iannacone, was a student of Becker's. And Becker won the Nobel Prize in Economics in, was it 87, 89, for applying economic tools to understand non-market behavior. And his work on the family, I think, was a big part of why he was awarded the prize. So his book came out actually in 81. It was about the same time as I was doing my dissertation, and so I didn't really know about it. My husband suggested it several years later.
And what was your dissertation on at Chicago? Was it on these topics? Was it on just gender and theology, or was economics already embedded in there?
It wasn't. Economics was not, but I'm general systems theory in social psychology or organizational psychology in many ways is economic thinking without the math. So it was fairly natural to think in terms of inputs and outputs and how the organization responds. Basically, what I was interested in my dissertation was looking at this massive social change, which has turned out to be even bigger than I ever dreamed of at the time, and that was the women's movement, which was taking women out of the household. And it was causing a lot of problems for the churches, of course, and especially for the churches like Roman Catholicism on the issue of contraception and the LDS on the issue of family roles, because they had essentially made them part of the theology. So you've got this situation where all the churches are having to change to adapt to these new social constraints and roles. But for the churches that had made the old ways part of their theology, which wasn't supposed to change, which was supposed to be eternally true, it was causing particular problems. So I've published a few pieces, actually, on the topic of how the Mormon Church responded and dealt with the whole changing women's roles.
Give us a little flavor for that. How did the Mormons change their view of women's roles? Or did they?
Well, they have. I think they've handled it quite nicely. Originally, the women's movement, let's date it to about, say, 63 is when Betty Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique, right, which was capturing, I didn't have these tools at the time, but you have, beginning with the Industrial Revolution, this massive change in the family. And let's think of the Industrial Revolution not as Henry Ford's making cars on an assembly line, but as the slow and steady movement of production out of the household. Now, prior to the Industrial Revolution, which is dated to about 1800, households produced themselves everything they consumed. And this is part of what Becker's an understanding of the traditional family or household is based on. So, you know, if you wanted to eat something, you had to plant it, water it, grow it, harvest it, cook it, you know, whatever. Everything was produced in the family. But beginning in about 1800, you have more and more of these things that the family had produced that are being produced outside of the family. It's being produced in the marketplace instead. So first, the men leave home. By the middle of the 19th century, most men were no longer butchering their own animals or growing their own corn, which was the staple of the American household. The men are instead looking for jobs to pay for the things they used to produce. And the children, now you have piped in water. You don't need all these kids to carry water or to collect firewood because you've got more efficient heating and cooking stoves.
That's what you think. I still have my teenager go collect water and firewood.
Well, you know,
it's good for them.
They probably would be investigated by social services as soon as we hang up.
Oh, okay. I don't do that, folks. I don't.
Because by 1930, you had all of these laws that pretty much mandated that children had to be in school and out of the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
So the nature of the household changes radically. And by the middle of the 20th century, it catches up with the women. And so about then, most people are out of the farms. They're not having 7.5 children per woman in the course of her lifetime, which was the birth rate at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And the things that the woman, I mean, there's still a lot of work to do in the household, but the housewife is not actually producing anything there. So she needs to do what her husband had done, 100 years earlier. That is go and find a job to pay for the things that she used to produce herself. So we have the women's movement starting, and by the end of the 60s and throughout the 70s, you have this enormous influx of women into the marketplace. And, of course, this threatens all of the Mormon teachings that, as I say, they have reified or made real or spiritualized the traditional sexual division of labor. And somehow it's not just an economic accident that the woman's at home and the man is the provider, but it's God's will, according to, you know, Mormon doctrine. So their initial response, and all the evangelical churches were, you know, all the churches were fighting about this at the same time. But the Mormon church's initial response was to come down pretty hard, condemn this, talk about, you know, women putting self-fulfillment of the desire for a color TV ahead of their children's welfare and their own spiritual well-being. And, you know, so they come down very hard. But as you start to move into the late 70s and then into the 80s, it's become very apparent that things are changing, and the church is doing their own internal surveys as well, which they never release, but sometimes bits of them are leaked. I'm probably on a list right now for saying this on the air. But they start making some accommodations. So they actually, the way it gets worked out, you know, reading their literature, there's a lot of conflict. There's a lot of, not open conflict, but a lot of conflicted statements. But ultimately, they come to this position where you continue to hold up the ideal. So the ideal continues to be the mother at home nurturing all these children and the father provider, but they're making all these concessions to reality. And they said, well, this continues to be the ideal, and, you know, this is the way it will be in heaven, and you should do this if you possibly can, and structure your life so that you can do it that way if you possibly can. But if you really have an economic need and your husband agrees and you know your kids are well provided for and you pray about it and God gives his blessing, then it's okay to go and work outside the home. And you know, the Mormon church probably single-handedly stopped the Equal Rights Amendment from passing. And so they were getting a lot of flack in the press. And they still get a lot of flack for being anti-woman, especially after recent developments where they excommunicated this young woman who was advocating to ordain women to the priesthood. But how they've dealt with this kind of anti-feminine perception is by kind of running up the value of women. So they talk more and more about how women are actually superior to men, and you know, so they don't dislike women or believe they're inferior. And indeed, there really has never been in Mormondom any implication that the woman is inferior to man. But they really spent a lot of time praising women and talking about how wonderful they are and more spiritual than men, and so forth.
Now, I was going to say, what you've done here is very interesting, because you're talking about an economic trend, the movement away from agrarian societies through industrialization and the sociological trends that occurs. And a lot of economists are going to be looking at that. Sociologists are going to be looking at that. But what you're introducing is a view of theology. Theology is really putting a brakes on a lot of these social changes. And that becomes the fascinating aspect of your research here. So you're using the economics, you're using history, you're looking at religion here, putting all those things together. And as we said earlier in the introduction, not too many people have really looked at the intersection of all three of those. How has your work been received in academia writ large, the fact that you're blending these three different perspectives or three different fields of research?
Tony, to tell you the truth, I have not really done much in academia since I started working in Africa. That's been pretty time-consuming. My board has told me to take some time and do some writing. But I presented mostly at the Association for the Study of Religion, Economics, and Culture, which is, of course, what I know you from.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been pretty well received, I think. But, you know, economics, sociology have become extremely quantitative. And I'm not doing quantitative research. And religion and, to some extent, sociology is pretty resistant to this kind of rational choice approach, which is inherent in the economics. So it's going to be interesting when I start trying to get things published.
Well, I think it's fabulous, and you should be publishing this stuff because it is interesting and it is well received at our ASRIC conferences. And I'm very happy that it's not very quantitative, because sitting through another quantitative panel there, not another regression analysis put up on the screen. But let's go ahead and dig into this, because this is how you do this in the pieces that you have written. It really changed my mind on a lot of things, and I hadn't really thought about some of these things before. And you're interested in a lot of issues about how Western missionaries dating back to the mid-19th century or so have used theology to inadvertently reinforce some cultural and economic practices that are inimical to women in Africa primarily, although you've been extending some of this to India and a few other places.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be the target of our discussion. But in order to get us there, I do think we have to examine some of your work more generally, theoretically, on economics, theology, and gender. And that takes us back, of all places, to the book of Genesis, the starting place, I guess. So explain to us how this first book of the Bible factors into all of your thinking here.
All right. Well, it's actually the third book that gives you the key, but let's start with Genesis 1. And Genesis 1 is held by just about everybody as being a very gender equal book. And of course, that's, you know, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth and all of the acts of creation, if you're up on your Sunday school knowledge. And then he gets around to creating humankind. And it's not man that he creates, but it's humankind. And the underlying Hebrew word is ha-adam. And it says, and God created humankind in his image, male and female created he them. So both the woman and the man are created in God's image. And then God blesses them both and blesses them with children and with dominion over the earth. Okay, so that's Genesis 1.
Okay, pretty egalitarian, right?
Very egalitarian.
Yeah, it's humans.
Got the woman and the man created at the same time. It's humanity that's created. It's a different word in Hebrew than the word for man. And they're both given children and dominion over the earth.
And this is a pretty cool time in terms of economics as well, right? Because this is paradise.
That's right. So you can't have economics in paradise, because economics is the study of choices made under conditions of scarcity. So what are we lacking in paradise to make economics useful?
That's scarcity.
Yeah.
No scarcity. Sounds like a good place. But for economists, it must be a hell, because no scarcity, no economics jobs.
That's right. Well, yeah. We got out of there pretty fast.
Oh,
we?
That's good. I guess that takes us to book two then. Or chapter two, I should say.
Yeah, yeah. Chapter two is a retelling of the creation of humankind. And it was understood in the whole kind of feminist theology as being text criticisms. Well, it was written by somebody else. It's a very patriarchal document, Genesis 2. It's a patriarchal telling of the Genesis 1 account. But I'm going to suggest that it's something different. That in Genesis 2, you have the story about the man being created alone, and then God saying it's not right that the man should be alone, and I will make him a help meet for him, or a helper as his partner. So this is regarded as being a kind of different creation account written by a different set of people, and these folks were sexist. But instead, I propose that it is something pretty typical in Hebrew poetry, and if you ever see the Old Testament in certain translations, you can see how much of it is poetry. But instead of rhyming words like English poetry used to do, you're rhyming ideas or concepts. And it's very typical in Hebrew narrative to tell a story one way and then tell it again slightly differently. And the slightly different rendition brings out things from the first. And in this case, Genesis 2 is explaining why God created us as gendered beings, as male and female sexed beings, I should say, not gendered. So Genesis 2 explains that when God creates the first human being, he only made one, but what he creates is not a man. It's not an ish. That's the Hebrew word for a man. Instead, what he creates is ha-adam, which is what he created in Genesis 1, humankind. And ha-adam actually is a play on the Hebrew word for the red earth, which he built ha-adam. Remember, he makes the man out of the dust of the earth, the human being out of the dust of the earth, and breathes the breath of life into him, and he becomes a living being. So that's not man, it's ha-adam. It's the earth creature that God made out of the earth, the human being. And then God immediately says, it's not good that the man should be alone. I will make him an azer kenegdo, are the Hebrew words, and these are the words that are translated in the King James as a help meet. Now that's kind of King James English, which is, 400 years old now? Meet meant suitable or equivalent or appropriate for him. But it gets immediately corrupted in English into a helpmate, which is not a biblical word. It's just kind of nonsensical word. And so it gets into the culture, into our historic understanding as the housemaid, essentially, in Africa. That's what they view that as. God said, well, the man needs someone to do the dishes and feed him. So this is one source of misunderstanding here. What God says, the man needs an azer kenegdo, the human being needs an azer kenegdo, and that's the word azer is help, and it's used 21 times in the Old Testament, and almost all of the times it's used to refer to God as our help. So I lift my eyes to the hills, whence comes my help is the Lord. The other times where it's used, aside from in Genesis 2, is to refer to a king coming to the aid of another king. So when God said Adam needs a help, he is not talking about a housemaid. He's talking about someone who's strong, a strong helper. And the next word puts the level. Okay, so he doesn't need a helper lower than him, and he already has God, so he doesn't need a helper higher than him, but instead he's getting a helper suitable for him or meet for him, and the Hebrew word means facing. So it's a help face to face with the man, help on the same level. And so then they go in Genesis 2, they go looking through the animals for the Acer Kinegdo. They can't find the help suitable among the animals, which tells you something there, but we won't get into that. And so God puts the Adam into a deep sleep, divides him in two, and it's not just a rib, it's the Hebrew word is for a hunk of him, a part of his side, and creates the woman out of that. And when the now Adam is referred to as a man for the first time, and so there's no man there, there's no ish until there's a woman, and he says, this one at last, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, she will be called Isha because she was taken from Ish. So now we have sexuality created. You've got these physical differences, and the difference between sex and gender has not occurred at this point. You know, gender is your kind of social expression of your sexuality, the way you behave, the way you interact with the world is considered gender, and we're using sex here to refer to the physical differences. So again, you've got this very egalitarian viewpoint of the creation of woman, and effectively he's not a man until she's a woman, so effectively they're created as sexed beings at the same time, and it's because it wasn't good to have just one. So then we move into Genesis 3. Oh, and this Genesis 2 ends with, and God said, the Creator says, for this reason, a man leaves his father and mother and holds fast to his wife, and they two become one flesh. So you've got one creature divided into two in such a way that they want to come back together in one again.
So very egalitarian reading.
Very egalitarian.
Yeah. Okay.
Of that. So you've got that consistently. Again, we're still in paradise. There's no economics. Well, what happens in Genesis 3 is, you remember from Sunday school, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden with no clothes on, and they're tempted by the serpent to do the one thing they'd been forbidden to do in paradise, which was eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the serpent tempts the woman. She gives the fruit to her husband, who is with her, and that's very important. It turns out in Africa, the fact that verse 6 of Genesis 3 tells us that the man is right there during the temptation. And then their eyes are open, they have the knowledge of good and evil. God finds them, they're hiding from God because now they have shame, so that one flesh naked and not ashamed relationship is broken by sin. But when God finds them, and finds out what they've done, he pronounces something that is usually called the curse. And this is, again, will be very prominent in our work in Africa and India. So in Genesis 3:14-19, the Lord God says to the serpent, because you've done this, you are cursed more than all cows, cattle, and so forth. And he says some things to the woman, and he says some things to the man. And these things, shall I read them?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so, to the woman he says, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In sorrow you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he will rule over you. So we've got an immediate breaking of the egalitarianism of the first two chapters. And then to the man, he said, because you heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying you will not eat of it, cursed is the ground for your sake. In sorrow you will eat of it all the days of your life, both thorns and thistles it will bring forth from you. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. So, what do we have now that we didn't have in Genesis 1 and 2?
Well, you can see there's going to be some non-egalitarian, I hear, rule over, and there's going to be a blame game played, I assume.
Mm-hmm. And then God says to the man, you're going to have thorns and thistles. So, and if you recall the end of Genesis 3, the people are driven out of paradise.
And so, end of Genesis 3, everybody leaves paradise, and all of a sudden we get economics.
Yes, because now you have scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
So the people have often talked about what I read you as the curse. I'm sure you've heard that used. But if you look carefully at the text, you see that the word cursed is only used twice. Once on the serpent and once on the ground. And the things that God tells the people, the man and the woman, are not curses, but they're consequences. And this is where the kind of Gary Becker explanation for the sexual division of labor, it fits right into this idea of the ground being cursed, and these particular things are consequences of the ground being cursed. Because now you're in an economic world. Well, what Becker attributed the traditional sexual division of labor, which was the woman, having a lot of children, being what economists call domestically specialized. She's tied to the household in a lot of ways. And the men not being domestically specialized it's going to fall out of the curse on the ground. So Becker attributes this to the need for a lot of labor in these subsistence pre-industrial kinds of cultures. Okay, so you have all of these things that we just take for granted are just there. And in a pre-industrial context, they're just not. So if you need clothing, if you need food, if you need medical care, just all of these things have to be produced within the household themselves. And the best source of labor, because this is extreme labor intensity, you need a lot of people, are children, your own children. So the woman, as the only producer of children, it will spend most of her life in these kind of contexts, pregnant, trying to get pregnant, nursing, and so forth. Well, what happens is you still have all of this work that has to be done. You can work full-time and still just barely survive. That's what subsistence means, right? And so the woman's going to be pregnant most of the time, but she still has to work. She can't just lie around with her feet up on the divan. So people very quickly within a generation learn that there's just some things you cannot do while you're pregnant and still sustain the pregnancy. So people learn to very quickly divide up the work so that the woman is not working very strenuously. Well, she's still working strenuously, but not strenuously enough to lose the pregnancy or to lose her breast milk when she's feeding the child, which there was no substitute for human breast milk until the last century. So it was a death knell if you didn't have someone to feed this baby. People learn to divide up work so that the women can do the things that are compatible with pregnancy, lactation, and having all these little kids around. And so the woman ends up being what economists call domestically specialized. She stays close to the house, and the things that get defined as men's work are the things that women can't do when they're pregnant. And that's essentially it. Men do the things that are left over. And so the woman ends up dependent on the man because, well, Becker says it's because it's easier for him to replace her than for her to replace him. But I think it goes beyond that, in that now men are doing the things that require coordinating the love labor of others. So you very quickly move into this very hierarchical society where you're either coordinating other people or they're coordinating you. And men end up in a lot of power struggle, striving for status and position over each other. And they, of course, they're going to bring that attitude home in a lot of ways. That, plus the fact that they own everything, usually in these kinds of economies, which gets labeled patriarchy. So the gender roles kind of fall out from there, whereas the woman is in the home. What's interesting is that before plow agriculture, or in places where they don't use the plow, farming is women's work. The men are off hunting or making war or clearing lands or so forth. But the women usually are doing the farming. And what becomes men's work versus women's work depends on the circumstances. So you see fluctuations around the world. But it pretty much follows this pattern that has to do with protecting a woman in her child-rearing role, not because they particularly, you know, esteemed women for their own sakes, but because that was where her greatest value lay.
That's where the additional labor came from.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that you see how that falls right at the things that God says to the woman in Genesis 3, which are taken as a curse and often as God's will for the relationship between man and woman, are actually consequences of the fact that the ground is cursed.
Now, one of the interesting things that I found in your writing was this issue about the plow. This one thing that just hit me that I had no idea of, that once the plow is introduced, it moves agriculture from, you know, farming used to be women's work out there plucking weeds or planting seeds or harvesting or whatever it might be, to making it men's work. And this is something that occurs predominantly in Europe, which has a play in here, because this changes the understanding of gender roles in the economy. So explain to me, if you can, what difference did the plow make?
Well, you can't plow when you're pregnant.
Really? And see, I don't know that. I wouldn't know that, because one, I'm not pregnant, and two, I don't plow. So, you know, it's
right,
the benefit of being in the 21st century. But yeah, I never thought about that.
Yeah. Well, the early plows were essentially a piece of steel, but you had to push it through the ground. And then when they invent the horse collar, then you are
makes it a little
having
easier.
The horse pull it. But even that takes a lot of strength, and it's just not something that's compatible with maintaining a pregnancy. So actually there's a little book by one of the first women economists. I think her name is Edith Bossarup, and it was published in 1970, called Women's Role in Economic Development. But she talks about what happens when you introduce plow agriculture, that farming goes from being woman's work to men's work, and how the men resist it because it is a lot more work in general. I mean, it's more productive. But she talks about how the colonial powers would come into places like Africa and India, and they would round up all the men to give them a lecture on modern farming techniques. And, of course, that was just a total waste of time because the men didn't do the farming.
Yeah, and that's going to cause this interesting conflict, right? This cultural conflict, which you write so well about. It's not just related to, you know, culture things, but, you know, there's this plow, the economics of, you know, division of labor and all that stuff that plays into it. And we're going to move into that, because there's a theology that affects this. And we've already talked about the theology of women's role in Genesis 1, 2, and 3 and how that plays out. But another thing that adds to the mix that's going to be important for Christian missionaries here is Christianity's role in defining or redefining gender. So how does this play out?
when you have this kind of traditional pre-industrial economy and you end up with households are pretty major affairs where you've got all these slaves and the woman having children and the man kind of being the patrician, you know, the patriarch there in charge of everything. And that becomes pretty much the norm as far as people thinking. And there's real tendency, I believe, to reify. I've been accused in Africa of all places of being an economic determinist, but I think the way your economy runs, the things that you have to do in order to survive, become in many ways our kind of moral norms. So if it's the way you, what is it, the expression, if it's inevitable, it's ideal. So there came to be this reading of Genesis 3 not as a description of what the world is going to be like outside of God's abundance, where the woman's going to have a lot of children. Genesis 3:16, God says you're going to have a lot of sorrow and a lot of conceptions. It's not pain in childbirth, by the way. That's a bad translation. And in sorrow, itzabon is the Hebrew word, you will bring forth children, and your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. So people viewed that as what God is saying is, they would read that out of context as God's prescription to the woman. That, you know, you're going to have a lot of kids, you're going to have a lot of kids in pain, and you're going to be subordinate to your husband. And then to the man, he says, you're going to have to eat your bread by the sweat of your brow. You're going to have a lot of sorrow, too. It's the same word that he uses with the woman. You're going to have a lot of itzabon, hard work, hard, painful work, sorrowful work, and you're going to die, essentially, at the end of it. So these get taken up as a curse. So if you... When I first started working in Africa, I had written a Bible study guide on gender in the Bible that covered some of these things, and I was invited to go over there. And I think it was my second trip. And of course, you know, the Bible is written to an economy way more like Africa than it is like the United States today. And people in these less developed, highly, highly religious countries, where I was in Uganda originally, are very Bible-oriented. But they understand the Bible. They get things that we don't get in a lot of ways because the Bible is written to you know, an economy that's much closer to theirs than to ours. But I was introduced to this notion of bride price, which I think we'll talk about a little later. But bride price is the custom, because the women do the farming, right? And so if you want to be wealthy in Africa, you need a lot of women. So the clans own the land, and a man would clear the land, but then if he didn't have a woman to farm it, if he just let it lie fallow, his brothers or other clansmen would come and claim it. So you wanted a lot of wives because they're going to produce a lot. So you end up creating a market for women, and you end up with bride price, which is pretty common throughout sub-Saharan Africa. You see it in the Middle East. There's even in China, in the rural areas, they practice bride price. And you see it in the Old Testament, in the story of Jacob working for Rachel for 7 years. So a bride price in Africa is usually cows or goats that the man or his clan pays to the men of the woman's clan. It doesn't go to the couple themselves in order to marry her. Okay. So I was very intrigued with this whole notion on my first trip. And my second trip, I was speaking to a conference of women's leader in a rural area of Uganda. And we're meeting in a great big meeting hall. It has a huge open doorway on one side, essentially was only three-sided. And it had a metal roof and a concrete floor. And so this is before they had the seminar, which is how Empower works now, but I was lecturing, and I had a flip chart. And I just thought to ask him, when a man pays bride price, what is he buying? And they said, children. And this is basically the main thing that a man is buying when he pays bride price is rights to the woman's children. And if he doesn't pay her bride price, these aren't really his kids. And there's stories about men who come along, you know, even now, and paid their mother's bride price to legitimate themselves. Their father had never paid her bride price. So I write children down on my flip chart. And then they say labor, because women do the farming, and they also do all the food prep. So I write labor / food down. And then it starts raining on this metal roof. If you've ever been in a building with a metal roof when it rains, Tony?
Yeah, it you can't hear anything.
You can't hear anything.
Yeah, it's like a ratchet hammer. Yeah.
So the women are screaming. I can't hear what they're saying. So Margaret, who's translating for me, walks down to where people are, and she comes back and she says, sex. They're saying sex. So I wrote sex down on the flip chart. And then they start shouting again. Well, it's raining even harder, but they're really insistent on something. So Margaret goes down and comes back, and she says, no, put that on top. Sex comes first. But this is really very traditional, typical of these pre-industrial economies, where the woman, you know, marriages are based on these economic transactions, and the woman owes the man things, and children, labor, and sex, and the man owes the woman things as well. He owes her land to farm. He owes her cows to milk. When you move into cash economies, you know, he's supposed to provide enough cash so that they can, you know, buy shoes for the children, send things they can't produce there. So the relationships, unlike the naked and unashamed one flesh relationship of Genesis 2 of creation, or the man and the woman ruling the earth together in Genesis 1, the marriage relationship is very transactional, where she owes him things, he owes her things, and aside from that, there's no real relationship. So people didn't go around together, they didn't hold hands, it wasn't a marriage relationship based on either erotic love or compassionate love. And in fact, in Africa, if a man does things for his wife that are outside the normal definitions of what a man should do for his wife, more than he owes her, or if he helps with her work, people think that she's gone to a witch doctor and had him bewitched.
Mm-hmm.
So these are very, very transactional kinds of relationships. Well, this is what emerges, where you're paying a bride price, but the relationship is based on children, labor, and sex from the woman, and then from the man's ability, his wealth on his side, that's what's admired in the man after the fall, his dominion over other people. So what we do with the biblical material in my theology of gender is now we go and look at what Jesus is saying about the role of women. And I owe a lot of this to a New Testament historian named Scott Barchi, who is just retired from UCLA, where he taught New Testament origins. But he points out how Jesus is always turning around assumptions about the sexual division of labor, how he is trying to return us to paradise in general. That's the whole idea of Christian redemption. But it's not just through the whole kind of mystic notion of shed blood and death on a cross, but through his teaching. So you've got the story of Mary and Martha. If you've been to Sunday school, you know that. The story of Martha, these two sisters, Martha and Mary, and Jesus and his band come to visit, and Martha's running around fixing lunch, right? Food and labor. And Mary's sitting at Jesus' feet. She's taking on the men's role of a disciple. And Martha's finally had enough, and she goes to Jesus complaining about her sister, and she says, tell her to help me. And Jesus says, you know, Martha, you're very worried and careful about many things, but Mary's chosen the better part. So, you know, Jesus pretty consistently says that your kind of spiritual status, your relationship with God, is more important than your gender role that's determined by society. With the whole question of woman as childbearer, this was pretty big in India as well, where they have the same kind of notion that, oh, you marry a woman to provide children, labor, and sex, although the women don't really do the farming. There's still a lot of work. And women who can't bear children are not really women in these kinds of cultures. In Africa, they're called worthless women. And, you know, those obligations are very real obligations. So if a woman doesn't have children or she has only girls, then her husband can get rid of her or, you know, replace her with a new wife, which worked when they practiced polygamy, but not so much now. Well, there's a story where Jesus is out preaching. This is in Luke. And a woman sees him and says, blessed is the womb that bore you and the breasts that nourished you. Because of course, women's status in these kinds of societies is based on having a great son, like Jesus, right? She was trying to praise Jesus. And Jesus says, no, blessed rather is one who hears the word of God and obeys it. So the idea that, you know, you're still a woman, you still have worth, even if you don't bear children, you don't bear sons. These are really critical things that are showing up in the New Testament and the whole idea of redemption. That's why my book was called The Redemption of Love. And then similarly in Paul, Paul is regarded as being a great advocate of patriarchy, of being very oppressive to women. And again, it's because people are reading the Bible through the eyes of this kind of spiritual reification of the traditional sexual division of labor. This is what they see in the world and think this must be what God's will is, so then they go back and read the Bible through those lenses. But Paul in Ephesians 5 and 6, where he's addressing household issues, actually undercuts all of that kind of understanding. But it takes some serious word study to get at it. But he redefines the family as one not based on these economic transactions or a patriarchal structure of the Roman world, which he was writing to, or the Mediterranean world in general at the time, but one based on agape love, of self-sacrificial love for the sake of the others. And he follows Jesus in quoting Genesis 2 as the ideal for the relationship between man and woman, and that was, for this reason, a man leaves his father and mother and holds fast to his wife, and they two become one flesh. we see the New Testament and the whole redemption story as returning us to relationships based on faith in God and living in paradise in faith, as opposed to struggling in the fallen world with the knowledge of good and evil, which was essentially the desire to be like God ourselves and control things ourselves.
Now, this sets up a really interesting paradox, and one that you address in one of your recent papers called The Accidental Syncretist, How European Missionary Teachings Fused with African Cultural Practices to Harm Women. You would see that, well, you know, Jesus is talking about changing our notions of the sexual division of labor. Paul starts talking about agape love and really putting the emphasis on Genesis 2, what we talked about earlier. So it seems like Christianity's pump primed to really make things a lot better. But you have this very interesting thesis that missionaries, you know, dating back to the 19th century and well into the 20th century, carry with them some theological ideas that, when blended with the traditional religions and the traditional gender roles and economic roles in Africa, really create some damaging impacts. Explain that, if you could.
Yes, yes, that was probably my biggest surprise in working with Africans. I was teaching in Burundi, again, before we had the seminar, and I was teaching on Genesis 3, and I said pretty much what I said earlier about if you read carefully, you see that the word curse is only used twice, once on the serpent and once on the ground. And the people weren't cursed. Well, I was lecturing, I was being translated, and the audience had been pretty quiet. These are kind of a syncretism of the Belgian school system. Burundi was a Belgian colony, and the African practices where you didn't ask questions in school. And in fact, if you ask your teacher a question and he can't answer it, you embarrass him, you might end up spending the afternoon standing out in the rain. So the audience had been very quiet up until now. And now I said that, you know, the woman and the man weren't cursed in Genesis 3. It was just the serpent and the ground. And the whole room starts buzzing. I asked my translator, they're Francophone, so I didn't understand either their language or French. So I asked my translator, what are they saying? And he said, you mean the woman wasn't cursed?
Mm.
And so, you know, I have no idea. No, that's right. I say, you know, look carefully. You see the word cursed is used only twice. And I go on, and they're buzzing even louder. The translator, what are they saying? And he said, you mean woman isn't cursed? Present tense.
Mm-hmm.
No, and so I explained it as if you see your little child walking towards the fire with their hand out, and you're the child's father, and you say, no, don't touch that, you'll be burned. And you he touches the fire anyway and is burned. Is the child suffering because you cursed him? And of course they all say, we didn't curse our child. That's what God is telling the man and the woman is going to happen to them as a consequence of their disobedience, of choosing to live outside of God's abundance, of not living in faith. But God didn't curse them any more than the father cursed the child who got burned. So they got that. They understood that. Well, it turns out, I'm pretty sure, it's hard to trace this, but I'm pretty sure they get the idea that woman is cursed, which is widespread throughout every place I've been in sub-Saharan Africa and in India as well. This belief that woman has been cursed by God. And they sort of believe the man was cursed too, but that woman is responsible in a way that that man isn't. This was taught by the European missionaries. Now, there may have been some, I don't think there was any of that before. They had the traditional sexual division of labor there, but the the women participated in the cultic traditional religious practices and so forth. So I don't think they believed that woman was uniquely cursed by God. But the traditional religions are largely, they're very transactional themselves. They are based on, you know, the gods don't really have any particular interest in people, according to Rodney Stark. And they'll do things for you, but you have to pay them. And in fact, I first learned this in Burundi when I asked people how their lives were different with the advent of Christianity. And they said they no longer went to the local god to make offerings for a large number of children. They didn't have to sacrifice sheep, so they saved a lot of money. But a big thing that you go to the gods for is to curse people. So the Europeans now viewed this as a curse, what God says to the woman in Genesis 3. You're going to have a lot of kids and in pain because of a bad translation. You're going to bring both children in pain, and you're going to be dominated by your husband. So that's a curse, and then it gets even beyond that. It gets taken as this is what God's will is for a woman. So they come in, and they're teaching this, and they're teaching this into a culture that practices traditional religions. And they know what a curse is. You know, it's not just, oh, I've got my period and I've got a, you know, pain. It's God is really trying to hurt you. And so the notion that the woman is uniquely cursed is really devastating. And the fact that the curse in Genesis 3 falls out neatly into their sexual division, you know, the traditional sexual division of labor. I mean, they can see that. It makes sense to them, right? That this is a curse, that woman is inferior, and that and the problem with the curse is that if you try to ameliorate it, if you try to make it better for someone who's under a curse, then the curse is going to come on you. So you don't want to get in the way of a cursed person. But it has very devastating effects. So women were regarded as being not only inferior, but this kind of the source of all evil. There's parts of Kenya where the men believe that if they greet a woman, it will take all of the blessing out of them. So they'll walk right past their wife without speaking to her, may not speak to her at all. The women grow up with a great sense of shame just for being women. The men grow up with this great false sense of entitlement that she has to give him these things, you know, the children, labor, and sex, and if she doesn't, any mistreatment, even beating her to death, is just fine because God has cursed her. It's really pretty devastating, and I think with Empower, of all the things that we do over there, it's getting past the idea that woman is cursed by God that has the biggest impact.
It is a really interesting notion. And then, again, you can see how theology, these conceptions of theology, what part of the Bible that you emphasize and how it translates into a different culture can really create some unintended consequences that affect people in terms of their social relations and economically as well. Which brings me to the question you just talked about, Empower International. Tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing there. What is this organization, and what have you been doing to somehow reverse some of these you know, misinterpretations that you've been seeing?
We work with, they've been mostly Christian and civic and educational leaders. We're working more in the universities now. who are recognizing that the way that women are treated there traditionally is wrong, and they're trying to do something to raise the status of women, but they're also concerned about the family breakdown that's happening there. You know, with the Industrial Revolution, you've seen this steady decay in the family. With, you know, the things in the United States with the divorce rate being so high and a lot of people not marrying at all and a lot of non-marital births. And this is happening in the developing countries as well. But it's sort of pseudo-development in that the goods and services of the developed world are available in Africa, certainly in India. But the things that men did traditionally to support a family that earn a living, those have largely gone away. You can't hunt anymore. The male half of the equation. There's not a lot of land left to clear. They're not allowed to practice polygamy, so even if they clear the land, they don't have the labor force to farm it. It's difficult to generate the kind of cash you need in a modern economy. With a smallhold farm, which is how they traditionally. So the men are in, the men are feeling a lot of despair as well. And, in these countries, they're seeing this family collapse and they want to do something about the way women are treated. And, they really like what we do. We send people on short-term, trips. To teach our seminars now, and we don't teach things ourselves. We have seminars where they're working through the Bible-based material, pretty much what I've outlined for you before. And they're working in small groups. We have maybe 30 or 40 leaders per seminar. We only go where we're invited, which is important. And they work in small groups. Each group does a different study. They come back. They teach each other what they've learned, and they make their own cultural applications, which is very important. When I was living in Virginia when we started this program, and I'd just gotten back from like my third trip, and a friend who works at the World Bank was having a picnic. And I ended up talking with a man from the International Monetary Fund who is in charge of all the African projects. So I was telling, you know, he asked what I'd been doing because I'd literally just gotten back from Africa. So I'm telling him about it, and all of a sudden he stopped me and said, "How do you get away with telling people that their culture's wrong?" You know, which is the million-dollar question, and I'm sure working with IMF, he, you know, you're not allowed to tell people their culture's wrong. It's very politically incorrect. But we don't. We don't tell people their culture's wrong. They are the cultural change agents. They're making their own applications. We're just providing them with this material to help them rethink the things that they've been taught wrong. You know, pretty much, as I say, by the early Christian missionaries, who I do not want to disrespect in any way. They did wonderful, wonderful things in Africa, and I certainly could not survive under the conditions that they often did not survive under either. But, you know, people have a tendency to see things through the eyes of their own culture,
yeah.
And that applies to the Europeans as well as the Africans.
So. It's one of those situations of lost in translation,
right? Yeah.
That you think you're saying one thing, but you don't know the colloquy of the environment that you're in, and they hear it somehow different and take the message in a much different way. And so it seems like Empower International is basically trying to understand Africa from Africa's perspective and correct some of the misunderstandings that have been going on in the past.
And it's been really quite powerful.
Mm-hmm.
They're quite amazing.
Let me finish off with this question, and that is, in your work and studying all of this, you know, going back to Genesis, looking at the New Testament and Ephesians and the writing of Paul, as well as your work there on the ground in Africa with Empower International, what things have you learned over the past two decades that have really changed your mind about the way you view the world?
Wow. Well, working in these less developed countries is a real eye-opener. My first trip there, I was invited to lecture at a university because I'd never been there. So I had no idea. And I'm talking about the traditional sexual division of labor, you know, the traditional world, pre-industrial, and then how the family's changing as a result of the Industrial Revolution. And I'm talking about all this stuff, and I'm realizing there's not doing them all. So that was very interesting. And in fact, we immediately, part of why we've switched to going to them doing the cultural interpretations is that I had no idea of any of this. You know, I didn't realize that women did the farming in these kinds of things. So I'm talking about how, when they invent the wheat mill in the United States, the staple shifted from growing corn, within the staple of your diet with cornbread to wheat bread, and how the men start leaving home and the men don't do these things anymore, and they're just looking more and more puzzled. And, you know, finally I said, what's going on? They said, but the women do those things here. You know, so because it's just a different world. So the idea of relationships as transactional is a very interesting one, and that the traditional religions tended to be very transactional too, and the way you treat each other and the way you treat your gods were parallel. And then that invites a different level of looking at Christian theology, and especially the book of Ephesians, which is all about, you've gone from this kind of Roman godfather patron system to where everything is very transactional, to one where you've got God as Father, who is provides all these things, even his own son, for free, and how you honor God then, who's changed the whole world around. So, you know, it's affected me certainly as a social scientist, but also as a theologian.
Mm-hmm. Well, some very powerful lessons there that we can take with us. And so my guest today has been Carrie Miles. Carrie, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you very much, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.